Hey friends, Max here. In honor of International Nurses Week, we're releasing an episode from Season 3, The Nurse and the Nurse. We are constantly in awe of the work being done on the front lines by our medical professionals while this pandemic rages across the world. Thank you, 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 thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm talking to you about Florence Nightingale.
Oh, perfect. Yes. I am going to be talking about Mary Eliza Mahoney.
Okay. Tell me about her.
Okay. Well, have you ever heard of her?
No, that name is completely new to me.
Me too, which is kind of sad because we're going to get into her story. And she was an incredible trailblazing nurse, but she's not Clara Barton, and she's not Florence Nightingale because she's not white.
Oh.
Ooh, get ready.
All right.
It's going to be great. So she was actually born in Massachusetts in 1845. Her parents were freed slaves from North Carolina.
Okay.
And they moved north before the Civil War started. Lucky them.
Oh, wow.
She was the oldest of three children, and her family was Baptist. Mary was a very frequent churchgoer growing up. And when she was 10, she was admitted to the Phillips School, which was one of the first integrated schools in Boston. They focused on teaching students the value of morality and humanity. And even though she only attended Phillips until fourth grade, it's believed that this like really intense education is kind of what influenced her early interest in nursing.
Oh, wow.
So obviously, nurses played a major part in the Civil War.
Absolutely.
So seeing this kind of emergence of nurses and like the need for nurses and good doctors also, we could get into that at some point. But that also probably kind of piqued her interest.
Oh, I would imagine so.
So she married briefly in her 20s to a doctor, but that did not last. And so Mary remained single for the rest of her life after they separated. But when she was 33... Mary was admitted into a 16-month-long program at the New England Hospital for Women and Children, which still exists today, but now it has a different name.
Okay.
The Dimmock Community Health Center. This hospital had only female doctors and also assisted women in the study of medicine.
How
cool.
It was
the first hospital in the U.S. to offer a nursing program.
Wow.
Right? Pretty awesome. And it was also the first institution that offered such a program that allowed women to work towards entering the healthcare industry. Their only criteria for the program was that applicants should be, quote, well and strong between the ages of 21 and 31 and have a good reputation as to character and disposition, end quote. So like your bedside manner is like the top.
How do you prove that?
Choice?
Do you bring a signed letter?
Do you have an interview,
like
maybe?
Like a guarantee?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm very well behaved.
I promise I am nice. Look at all the people that I forced to sign this letter.
I will not take the pills.
Right. So Mary was actually outside the age requirements, if you remember. So she's 33 and they only wanted people 21 to 31.
Ah.
But she had previously been working at the hospital as a cook, maid, and washerwoman since she was 18.
Oh.
She worked at the hospital nearly 16 hours a day for 15 years.
Good.
Until she got into the program.
Oh my God.
Like,
good Lord.
Mother freaking never giving up.
I mean, she did what she had to.
Right.
It's like being a PA trying to be
definitely,
a producer.
Definitely. So the training required that applicants spend at least 1 year in various hospital wards so that they could get sort of universal nursing knowledge.
Kind of like being a resident or
a fellow. Yeah, exactly, which totally makes sense. The program consisted of a 5:30 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. shift.
Oh, my word.
And also required Mary to attend lectures and lessons to educate herself from the doctors at the hospital.
When did she sleep?
That's the answer. She never slept. The nurses were in charge of the well-being of six patients. So aside from this intensive program, she also worked for several months as a private day nurse. So I'm not joking. Like literally, she probably never slept.
Oh,
she was one of those people that slept 4 hours a night and then was like, I'm good.
And she could probably like close her eyes, fall asleep for like 10 seconds.
Well,
pop back
all
open.
Like nurses and doctors can do that. Like they once you go
standing up.
Yeah. Like once you go through residency, I know a couple of nurses and like surgeons and doctors. And it's like once you go through residency where literally your shift is like 36 hours or something, they all have the ability, yes, to fall asleep in any condition.
Wherever they are.
Lights on, noise, doesn't matter. But then they can wake up like at
and
the drop of a hat.
Ready to go and
yeah.
And size yeah. some, I don't know. Is that right. a term? Incise? Is that a tooth?
I think incisor? So. Well, incisor is a tooth, but like incision is a thing.
There you go.
We're somewhere in there. So the last 2 months of the program required the nurses to use their knowledge and skills in a new environment like private hospitals or family homes. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Mary's got a leg up on that. She's already working as a private nurse.
Right.
So she graduated in 1879 as a registered nurse alongside three of her colleagues of the 28 that started out. 28 to 4. Okay. Let me just paint that picture again. 28 people, 4. Because they don't sleep. Enter. They don't
Only
sleep.
Four leave.
Only 4 survive. And she was the first Black woman in America to do so.
Wow.
And we don't know her
Which
name.
Which makes the accomplishment so much
oh
more
Oh my
impressive.
God, right?
What year is this again?
1879.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
So she worked for several years as a private care nurse, and she gained a distinguished reputation. She worked for some of the most prominent families in Boston at the time. And during this time, African-American nurses were often associated with household servants. Of course, sure. insert eye roll. So in order to distinguish herself, Mary would eat dinner by herself in the kitchen instead of with the existing help.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I also think she was introverted. Like, she remained single the rest of her life. No judgment,
she
Mary.
Just wanted
I am
to be
also
alone.
Introverted. No judgment.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
And she would also say that she preferred working as a private care nurse because of the discrimination that Black women faced in public nursing yeah. at the time, which makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Her reputation was basically for being a very efficient nurse, and it continued to grow. And her professionalism actually helped raise the status of nurses in general.
Oh, wow.
But especially for minority women who sought to be nurses. Yeah. Many expressed that gaining better treatment for minority nurses was very important to her, and even noted that her distant relation to Frederick Douglass made her more inclined to fight against racial discrimination. Like, low key.
If my great-great-great uncle yeah. was Frederick Douglass, I feel like that would drive me too.
Exactly. And then you would never sleep and wash laundry for 15 years.
I mean, I already don't sleep.
This is fair.
But I don't. I'm
Still
not a
wash
nurse
laundry.
For 16.
Right. So in 1896, Mary became one of the original members of the predominantly white Nurses Associated alumnae of the United States and Canada,
okay.
which would later become the American Nurses Association.
All right.
But of course, Mary found the group to be unwelcoming to African-American nurses, so she decided to start her own organization with the help of other nurses of color.
Look at her.
Including Martha Minerva Franklin, another advocate of racial equality in the uh-huh. nursing field. So in 1908, they founded the National Association of Colored Graduate Nurses. And this organization didn't tolerate discrimination towards anyone and aimed to support and recognize the accomplishments of all nurses.
Good.
It kind of reminds yes. me of TASC at UNCG.
Yeah.
Where they were like, you can join Whites of Color. And I'm like, okay, great, thanks. I just want to do plays. Oh, it's the Theatrical Alliance for Students of Color at UNCG. Is it national or was it just a UNCG?
You know,
I actually don't
sure.
know. But it was started out. By a group of African-American students mm-hmm. at UNCG. I don't know if they just had low members or what.
I don't know if it was
like
national,
an open audition.
A national thing or whatever.
Right.
But they did put on shows and,
yeah.
and workshop pieces
yeah.
where they had invitations for everybody.
Right.
Absolutely. I feel like it's a lot of a way that we talk about feminism, or we try to talk about feminism these days, where it's
yeah.
like feminism is not
just about women.
Just about advancing yeah. the cause of women. It's about the
right.
economic, social, yada, yada, yada,
exactly.
quality of everybody.
So in 1909, Mary spoke at the first NACGN's National Convention, which marked the first time that Martha Minerva Franklin and Ada Bell Samuels Thomas met Mary in person.
Oh, wow.
So Ada Bell, also another pioneering nurse for equality in nursing, and she fought for African Americans to serve as Red Cross nurses during World War I, and she was an important facet in the fight against the flu epidemic of 1918.
Oh wow.
Just quick side note.
Fun note.
So only 26 nurses attended the first convention, and in her speech, Mary acknowledged the inequalities that she faced during her nursing education and continued to face in her career. The group then gave Mary a lifetime membership and position as the organization's chaplain.
Look at that.
Right? So from 1911 to 1912, Mary served as the director of the Howard Orphan Asylum for Black Children in Kings Park, Long Island. It served as a home for freed African-American children and the elderly, and she would actually spend sort of the rest of her career at this institution. She was obviously actively involved in the women's suffrage movement.
Of course she
Go
was.
Go figure.
Sure.
In 1920, when women were given the right to vote in the U.S., Mary was among the first women to register in Boston.
Look at her.
I know.
I mean, this is a woman who literally said, oh, you guys aren't going to be welcoming to me. I'll just go start my own.
Exactly. Yeah.
She enfranchised herself.
Exactly. She brought her own chair.
Exactly.
Now, sadly, in 1923, she was diagnosed with breast cancer and died three years later at the age of 80. She died in 1926.
Dang.
Right? So the NACGN established the Mary Mahoney Award in 1936. And when the organization merged with the American Nurses Association in 1951, the award continued. It's continually given out annually in recognition of significant contributions in advancing equal opportunities in nursing for members of minority groups.
Look at that.
In 1976, Mary was inducted into the American Nurses Association Hall of Fame, one of the first inductees after the Hall of Fame had been established. And she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame in 1993. And today there are several health and medical centers named after her. And the Mary Eliza Mahoney Dialysis Center is a stop on the Boston Women's Heritage Trail.
Wow.
Right?
How cool is that?
I love it.
What an amazing woman.
And again, like, it bums me out that I don't know her name.
Yeah, truly. I mean, the fact that she was a person of color who was one of four people to come out of this, like, insane program.
Insanely intense program.
And then she went on and said, that's not it for me. I'm going to go and start my own thing and do my own thing and help as many people as I can.
Oh, yeah.
That, I think, is my favorite part, that she, like, put the hand back down to
help
other people
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Of course.
Yeah.
Take it away.
Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
For Florence Nightingale.
I'm so ready.
Okay. Florence Nightingale, of course, is one of those names that, like, everybody knows.
Totally.
Kind of hard not to know.
Right.
What I found is that just like every other woman that starts out on this podcast as everybody knows her, i.e. Joan of Arc, for example.
Right.
There's a lot that I had no idea about.
Oh,
with
I'm
her.
So excited. And, I'm so excited.
So she was born in Florence, in Italy, on May 12th, 1820. And her father, William E. Nightingale, was a landowner who had inherited an estate in Derbyshire, England.
Mm.
She came from a fairly well-to-do family. I mean, her parents were both kind of like, none of them had to work. Her father, I listened to one documentary that described him as kind of like a dilettante. Like, he just kind of like stayed on one or both of their estates and just did whatever he wanted to.
All right.
You know, a good life.
For real.
And she actually only had one other sibling, a sister named Parthenope.
Ooh.
Growing up, they were tutored in languages, math, and history. Their parents wanted them to have a very wide-ranging education.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the research I was looking at also said that because their parents didn't have a male son, a male
Ooh,
child,
yeah, makes
that
sense.
Florence is the oldest,
kinda
the
got
oldest
that.
Kind of got
right.
all of that.
Makes sense.
Now, in 1838, which when she's 18, she starts traveling Europe with her family, and she meets this woman. Her name is Mary Clark, who was an English woman living in Paris. And Mary was the first woman that Florence had met who didn't hold her appearance to, like, the utmost importance, didn't think highly of her looks,
Ooh.
Spoke her mind, believed that women were equal to men, was the first woman to, like, espouse these ideas that was also of the same higher class as Florence. She really is the one who planted the seed of being kind of brash and doing what you want to do. And they actually remained friends for almost 40 years.
Amazing.
Past that initial encounter. Now, from a very early age, Florence knew that she did not want to have the life that her parents had. She kind of saw this life of leisure and doing whatever and said, no, I would like to have a life of service instead. And she started drawing herself towards working in hospitals at first. During this time, hospitals were really not a reputable place to work.
Death holes.
I mean, literally, people went there
to die.
To die. Hold on, I found this quote. Caroline Worthington, who is the director of the Florence Nightingale Museum, said, when she started out, there was no such thing as nursing. The Dickens character, Sarah Gump, who was more interested in drinking gin than looking after her patients, was only a mild exaggeration. Hospitals were places of last resort, where the floors were laid with straw to soak up the blood. Florence transformed nursing when she got back from Crimea, which is something I'm going to talk about in a little bit. Because she had access to people in high places and she used it to get things done, Florence was stubborn, opinionated, and forthright, but she had to be those things in order to achieve all that she did. Unquote.
Love.
Right.
Love it.
So she goes in, starts working in nursing, and her family very strongly objects to this chosen career. And in fact, it's around this time when she also starts being pursued by a poet and a politician. His name is Richard Monckton Milnes. Courted her for 9 years.
Talk about stubborn.
I mean, to a certain extent, she kind of led him on. She let him keep doing it because she didn't outright reject him until the 9th year. And it was only because she thought that a marriage would detract from the work that she was doing.
Well, she probably wasn't wrong.
I mean,
during those times.
Exactly right.
Oh, man.
She's eventually able to receive permission to spend a few months at this place called Kaiserwerth, which was a training school for nurses, but it was in Germany.
Yep.
And then in 1853, she uses her status and her knowledge of people to become superintendent of this London charity, which was called the Institution for Sick Gentlewomen in Distressed Circumstances. Which allowed her to become independent.
That's the place of last resort.
Distressed gentlewoman.
That is how I'm going to describe myself the next time you're like, Allison, how are you doing? Whew, I am a distressed gentlewoman today.
That same year that she becomes the superintendent of this charity, the Crimean War breaks out, which is a fight between Russia and British and French forces, and with Russia pushing westward. Now, in March of 1854, the next year, reports started coming into England about the lack of medical supplies available to the wounded soldiers in the war. And the minister for war is a politician named Sidney Herbert. Actually a good friend of Florence Nightingale. They'd known each other for quite a while at this point.
All right.
He invites Florence to oversee the introduction of female nurses to the hospitals in Turkey.
Oh, wow.
So she recruits 38 nurses from all different walks of life.
Wow.
Says, pack up your stuff. We're going to Crimea. The whole coalition is actually not just these 38 nurses. There's also a contingent of 15 Catholic nuns who go as well.
Whoa.
Florence actually doesn't directly oversee. And in fact, the nun who does oversee them, Florence doesn't like very much. They get into like a kind of like a professional rivalry.
Yeah.
Of sorts.
Yeah. Power struggle.
Exactly.
Power struggle. I feel that.
And so they go to this hospital named Scutari, which is desolate. It's just a horrible place. In fact, a lot of the research that I was looking at said that you were actually better off being in a hospital on the front line than being sent to this hospital.
Oh, man.
Because almost all of the people that went to Scutari never returned.
Whew.
They died of a myriad of things, which I'm going to get to in a second. Now, when they first get there, they're, of course, not accepted by the doctors who are working there. And it's a lot to do with the thoughts of the time. In fact, there's an instance, a recording of a complaint that one doctor makes about Florence.
I think I've heard this.
Where he complains about her changing a dressing on a wound on a man whose penis was exposed because they were working on him.
Right.
And so the doctor said that this was untoward. She was being unladylike in dressing this wound.
Insert
so basically,
face bomb.
What Florence did was she said, don't say anything. She said this to her 38 nurses. Yeah. She said, don't say anything and don't do anything unless you're specifically asked to do it. And so they got there.
Oh, I love this moment. Oh my God, I love this so much. This is like the ultimate F you.
And so they got there in like a kind of break in the fighting.
Yeah.
And the first time they got this huge surge of battle wounded, they were so overwhelmed. The doctors were like, just do what you have to. And so they were finally able to prove through work that they knew what they were doing, that they could actually be female nurses. But it was only because like she was like, okay, don't
so
do
smart.
Anything.
So smart.
Don't do anything.
I love it.
The biggest problem about this hospital, Scutari, like I said, was that it was gross. It was absolutely disgusting. And a lot of the people who died there, for example, in the first winter she was there, 4,077 men died at the hospital. 10 times as many soldiers died from typhus, typhoid, cholera, dysentery, and other communicable diseases than from the actual wounds that they arrived at the hospital with.
Yep.
And so what ends up happening is that you know, she's fighting this uphill battle. She writes to the London Times, basically this plea saying, this is what's happening. We need help. And the government finally takes a stand, and they basically invite this company to build this hospital in England that they can take apart and ship over to Crimea, which helps to lessen the burden on Scutari. And then what they also did is that they sent a whole bunch of people to Scutari to basically clean the whole place. They cleaned out all of the different hallways. Mm. And these hallways were, it's described as miles of beds. There was beds. The beds were 18 inches apart. Hallway, every room, everywhere. They didn't even have a place for them to prepare food that didn't have soldiers also dying, essentially. So they cleaned everything out, cleaned out all the high ceilings, and flushed the sewers as well. They arranged to have the sewers flushed because apparently Scutari was built on top of a giant cesspit.
Oh my God.
So it was like... And so while Florence Nightingale is known for helping to spur all of these clean initiatives and helping to create sanitary situations and all this in these hospitals, it's not at Scutari that she ends up doing this. At Scutari, she had advocated for personal cleanliness, for being as clean as you could, for the soldiers to have clean bandages and the nurses to have clean hands, but not the actual environment and that they were in. And so it's here where we kind of come to this weird dichotomy between Florence Nightingale's actual role in Crimea and what the British people thought of her back home. Because there were so many soldiers going through Scutari at the time, Florence ended up being written into so many of their letters home that she became famous in the UK almost simply because of these letters that these soldiers were writing home. She's immortalized as the Lady of the Lamp, Florence Nightingale, the Lady of the Lamp, from two places in particular, one of which is the Times, who writes this article that says she's a ministering angel without any exaggeration in these hospitals. And as her slender form glides quietly down each corridor, every poor fellow's face softens with gratitude at the sight of her. When all the medical officers have retired for the night and silence and darkness have settled down upon those miles of prostrate sick, she may be observed alone with a little lamp in her hand, making her solitary rounds. So that's in 1856.
Okay.
And then the next year, 1857, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow writes a poem called Santa Filomena, in which he says, "Lo, in that house of misery, a lady with a lamp I see, pass through the glimmering gloom and flit from room to room." And so those two kind of immortalize Florence. But Florence herself never took credit for the recovery of Scutari. Because after, I mean, after they go and clean it out, mortality rates improve and all that fun stuff. She never takes credit for any of that. In fact, she was incredibly media shy. After she comes back from the war, her first picture that she takes, the first like press pictures that she takes are only taken at the implicit insistence of Queen Victoria herself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So after this whole, after the whole Crimea War, she comes back essentially a war hero.
Right.
One of the main war heroes of the war, even though she had never fought at all. She is given an engraved brooch by Queen Victoria herself called the Nightingale Jewel.
Wow.
And a prize of £250,000.
Oh my gosh.
From the British government. While she'd been in Crimea, she had also started what was known as the Nightingale Fund on November 29th, 1855. And on her return, donations just poured into this fund. So with it, she used the money to travel to different hospitals around Britain, reforming their nursing programs. Right. And she started using statistical charts in order to convey the need for medical reform to the larger society as well. Mm. She actually started using the numbers to say, here's what it was before, here's what it is after.
Smart.
And this is really what Florence is known for throughout the rest of her life. The reason why she is so famous now, the Crimean War happens, I mean, almost 40, 50 years before she actually passes away.
Right.
And so for the rest of her life, all she's doing is advocating. And some of the research I saw says that she was she felt guilty for not realizing, not taking the leap to thinking, you know, we need to clean the hospital as opposed to just cleaning
right.
the people. In 1959, she writes this book called Notes on Nursing, which basically becomes like a handbook yeah. for nurses. There's another quote I found in this book. Mm-hmm. She says, everyday sanitary knowledge, or the knowledge of nursing, or in other words, of how to put the Constitution in such a state as that it will have no disease or that it can recover from disease, mm-hmm. takes a higher place. It is recognized as the knowledge which everyone ought to have, distinct from medical knowledge, which only a profession can have. Mm. So she's the first one to really come in and say, everyone should know about all right. of this that's happening. So 1859, she writes this book. 1860, she establishes a nursing school. She establishes the first secular nursing school in the entire world.
Wow.
Which then starts disseminating this information right. on nurses around the world. Now, 1857, 3 years earlier, she had been hit with this sickness. It's basically an infectious disease. Most people these days think it's something called brucellosis, which comes from drinking unpasteurized milk or eating meat from an animal that's infected with it. And basically what it does is it causes profuse sweating as well as intense joint and muscle pain.
Ooh.
And so this leaves her basically intermittently bedridden from the time that she's 38 in 1957 till she dies at 90.
Oh my God.
On August 13th, 1910. And that's really where I think one of the reasons why she's not as well known for right. the second half of her life is, one, because she was very media shy.
Right.
And then two, because she was bedridden for most of the time.
Right. Wow.
Now, she used it very much to her advantage. In that time, she wrote more than 13,000 letters of support.
Wow.
Support of cleaner hospitals, cleaner nursing standards and facilities. I mean, basically everything that she could. She would write letters about. People would come to her house and basically sit downstairs, and she would they would send up her, you know, things for her.
Right.
She'd write something, and then she'd send it back down. And she'd also use it if she didn't want to see somebody. She'd be like, "Oh no, I'm too sick.
Nice.
I'm too sick to see
love,
you today."
Love it.
And I should also note that some of those 13,000 letters were with Queen Victoria, who she stayed in contact with for more than 30 years after she comes back from the war. In 1883, she becomes the first recipient of the Royal Red Cross. Mm. In 1904, she is appointed as a Lady of Grace of the Order of St. John, which is an international order that is about helping to increase health and wellness around the world. And she's appointed this by the monarch of England at the time. In 1907, she becomes the first woman to receive the Order of Merit, which is Britain's highest civilian decoration. Right. In 1908, she receives what's known as the Freedom of the City of London, which is essentially, like, in America, we call this giving them the key to the city. Exactly.
Nice.
And in 1910, she receives a personal birthday message from King George.
Wow.
Right.
Love it.
1910, that same year, August 13th, as I said before, she dies at the age of 90.
Whew.
She asks that she does not have a state funeral and is instead buried in her local churchyard.
Wow.
She has a very quiet ceremony. I believe I read it's somewhere between 30 to 90 people came in total. And I mean, she was absolutely amazing. I mean, that's Florence Nightingale. In her lifetime, she writes over 200 books, pamphlets, articles, 13,000 letters.
Oh,
I mean, she literally is just a machine.
Amazing.
Yeah. So that's Florence Nightingale, the lady with the lamp. Yeah. Oh, before I forget, she also became one of the first people ever to have her voice recorded.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to play it real quick.
Okay.
She writes it to raise money for the veterans of the Charge of the Light Brigade. This is July 30th, 1890.
Okay.
Recorded to wax cylinder.
At Florence Nightingale's house, London, to die the project, 1890. When I am no longer even a memory, just a name, I hope my voice may perpetuate the great work of my life. God bless my dear old comrades of Dalek Lava and who Greenback came to Shaw. Madam, thank you.
She says her name at the end of it. Did you hear that?
So cool.
Florence Nightingale.
Thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Hey friends, if you are enjoying this episode, can you do me a quick favor and just subscribe, leave us a review, give us a rating on whatever platform you're listening on, because those ratings and reviews help other people find the show, which is how we get to keep doing the show. Thanks.
If you are enjoying this show and you've already left us a rating or review, or even if you haven't, you should either download the Patreon app or go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor and help us out. For $1 a month, $2 a month, $10 a month, you can help us make this podcast happen. Thanks. All right.
So what I was thinking about in this episode is back in old school days of bitchery of history when we had terms to define. It's not really a term to define, but I was just thinking about like sexual discrimination that mm-hmm. women face going to the doctor. And I have a friend who was in a car accident. She's totally fine now.
Good. Glad.
But she's been going to all these follow-up appointments mm-hmm. and scans and different things with her husband. Mm-hmm. And her husband has just been commenting like, oh my God.
Yeah.
These men are atrocious to you. And she's like, yeah, that's life. Like that, what else is new?
Right.
Kind of.
Right.
And it's part of me is kind of glad because I feel like it's one of those things like taking your car as a woman, taking your car to like get the oil change.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it doesn't matter how many times that I tell a man what my experience is like until mm-hmm. you like can see it in the flesh.
Yeah.
It's like you just don't get it. It's not that they, it's not maybe that men don't believe me,
mm-hmm.
but it's more just like you don't know how condescending that it can be.
Well, there's a difference between like belief and understanding, or a difference between
yes.
like
oh, yes.
empathizing,
good point.
Empathizing
yes.
and sympathizing.
Yes.
Like one needs knowledge of like
right.
intimate knowledge of a subject.
Right.
What that makes me think of is, you know, Serena Williams, when she gave birth
yes.
this past
oh
year.
Oh my God.
Literally looked at her doctors and said, this is what is wrong with me. It has happened in the past. You don't need to do all of these other tests. Do this test and you will find out what's wrong with me.
Right.
And they said, no, 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 we're going to do all these other tests. And then they came back
as
nothing.
She almost died.
She literally almost died. One of the best athletes living right now.
It's just insane.
And she also wasn't believed.
Yeah. It's just crazy. Yeah. I mean, luckily, I personally haven't had that much discrimination mm-hmm. when I go to the doctor. But it does also make me be like, well, obviously, I only want a female gynecologist.
Yeah.
Because why else am I going to go to the doctor? You know?
Right.
Like,
it's kind of like, and I mean, I'm a man, so I don't know. I don't have personal experience, but I think what I have is experience as a gay man going to the doctor.
Yes.
When I moved to Los Angeles, I went to a doctor and I still go to them now.
It's where you referred me to go.
I did. I referred you to them. And it was the first doctor, and it's a gay-centric or queer-centric, I should say, practice. And mm-hmm. this was the first doctor I had ever had in, what, 23 years of life at that point, who had asked me questions specific to the queer experience, who asked me questions that the only thing I can think of is either my past doctors were either uncomfortable, embarrassed, or just didn't know.
Or just didn't
ask those questions. Exactly.
You know, like, I don't know if you're asked necessarily your sexual orientation when you go to the doctor. I don't know if I am. If I've ever, like, ticked off a box being like, I am a straight person.
I mean, not I'm in a roundabout way. I have been. I mean, I've been asked, you know, do you, you know, are you sexually
right.
active? And then the next question is with men or women, because that question is actually.
Oh,
like,
I think maybe that's what I was asked.
Yeah, because that question. I mean, that's what keeps me from donating blood. Is that
I'm just terrified of needles.
I mean, that I say that to say that. That is an interesting dichotomy, or that's an interesting,
totally.
Not dichotomy, but a parallel.
Totally. I mean, the only thing that I was going to say that I could think of is when I did go to that doctor,
mm-hmm.
They wanted to take some blood. It was my first visit there,
right.
So I'd just gone through, like, yes, I eat healthy, and I exercise, and blah, 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 like, my whole life, basically.
Right.
And so I said, I run and I lift weights, and then they want to take some blood, and I told the doctor, like, I'm really not good with needles, I tend to get very lightheaded, and I've almost passed out a few times.
Right.
A, I'm telling you this because I'm terrified and I'm hoping you're going to change your mind. And B, like, you need to know because I could pass out on your floor. Mm-hmm. And he just goes, oh, no, you'll be fine. You're like a strong superwoman. You know, you run and you lift weights. I'm like, uh-huh. Yeah, right.
Right.
Sure enough, when I'm checking out and like paying at the counter, oh, boy, I definitely almost passed out.
Oh, that's so unfortunate. I'm sorry.
And the lady was at the checkout, not the cash register, but, you know, checking me out.
The receptionist,
like, the receptionist, you know, do you want to go back in and lie down? Are you going to be okay? I'm like, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. And I was. I sat in the lobby. I drank some water. I drove home. But then the next time I went to the doctor, I made my best friend drive me because she's awesome and lovely. Because that time they were going to take more. They took like, I don't know, an ounce. And then this time they were taking like a pint or something. Who knows? They were taking like double the amount, triple.
It makes me uncomfortable thinking about blood and pounds and
I know. I don't either. Like, I'm going to get lightheaded and pass out right now just thinking about it. But again, that's nowhere near as severe. And I don't think he even meant it in like a non-believing negative way. Sure. It was just like, again, here I am telling you, no, I am truly not good with needles. And I have come very close to passing out before. Right. And I don't want to pass.
I feel like I'm about to pass out. It's I have done this in the past.
Exactly. And him just being like, no, you'll be fine. Right. Well, I wasn't fine.
It's an experience. I mean, it really just goes towards, you know, thinking about, you know, when we create these structures, you know, we do have to think about institutional forces. We have to think about, you know, the biases that we have without even really thinking about them or that without even really understanding them. And not having another person's lived experiences, which is like the definition of being human, you know, necessarily opens you up to not understanding another person's lived experiences.
Did we ever talk about those That's Harassment videos that David Schwimmer made?
I only
watched two of them because I was so uncomfortable, which means they're incredibly well made. But I was just like, oh, he can't. I feel gross. But he made the series of videos or helped other people make them. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. David Schwimmer's tied to it.
Google it in some way, probably.
They're fantastic videos. And they came out, interestingly, before the whole Me Too thing. Came out, I don't remember when. But it was basically a series of short videos of scenarios that me watching it, I'm like, I'm so uncomfortable. Like, this is such horrific harassment that I'm witnessing. But a lot of people may not see it that way. And there is one episode that's at a doctor's office, and the male doctor, it's just like a general checkup, starts basically feeling her up and being like, well, when did you last have a mammogram? And maybe I feel a lump here and whatever. And the woman is freaking out. Being like, well, do you like, do I need to get scanned, all these things? And he's like, oh, no, well, maybe now it's fine. And that, of course, is a very extreme example, but that doesn't mean that doesn't happen.
Oh, I'm sure it does all the time. I mean, we just went through the whole Larry Nassar thing.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that is literally a doctor who was taking advantage of more than 100 people.
So anyway, sexual discrimination at the doctor's office is real.
Yeah. And I think that one of the ways that you, and I know that this is me as a white man saying this. So, I mean, take this with a grain of salt.
Always.
But I do.
I love you.
But I do think that, you know, at a certain point, you should take agency. I think if the Me Too movement has taught us anything, it's that if you don't feel comfortable in a situation taking agency to say, no, this makes me uncomfortable, or no, you know, it should be done this way, or no, this is actually what I mean, that there are resources for you to then reach out to help or to do something. Like the changing the culture is now on all of us to a certain extent. And I think part of that is taking the agency to say, I would like to change this, or I'm going to get help in changing this.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Since we're talking about old school bitchery of history, let's do a quick today in history.
Oh, sure.
This week is International Nurses Week, which culminates in the International Day of Nurses, which is on this Saturday, May 12th. It happens every year on that day because it's Florence Nightingale's birthday.
Oh.
Yeah. So, happy International Nurses Day. Cause of the week?
How about the American Red Cross?
Amen.
They are at redcross.org. Mm-hmm. Go figure. The American Red Cross prevents and alleviates human suffering in the face of emergencies by mobilizing the power of volunteers and the generosity of donors.
Awesome.
And they are at redcross.org.
Fantastic. They do amazing work.
Totally. And if you're not gay like Max or terrified of needles like me, go donate blood.
And I will be honest and say that I think that law is dumb and it should be changed.
Let's work on that. If you want to keep in touch with us, maybe share your own stories of doctor visits. If you're up for it, why not start a conversation? You can find us on Facebook. Just search The Bitchery of History. We've got a page, a discussion group. We are on Twitter at Bitchery Podcast, and Instagram is at The Bitchery of History. And if you want to get in touch with us, get some merchandise, find out about past women that we've covered, just go to umpboh.com.
As always, we could not do this without our amazing team. So thank you, Kim,
Jeanette,
Sydney,
and Jess.
Also, I just wanted to say thank you, Allison, as we go into our last 4 episodes of The Bitchery of History for season 3.
Oh, thanks, Max.
Thank you for everything.
So remember,
bitches get stuff done.